I recognize a few faces out here. It's nice to be back. Over the past month, the Commission of Inquiry into Human Rights in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has been traveling in Seoul, Tokyo, and now Geneva. And the commission is led by Mr. Michael Kirby as chair of the commission. And today he is going to cover what he told the council this morning in his oral update. He'll speak for a few minutes and then we'll open it up to questions. Mr. Kirby.
Good afternoon, everybody. The last time I spoke in this room, I spoke for so long that there wasn't enough time for questions, or many questions, and I hope that there will be a number of them this afternoon. As I mentioned this morning before the Human Rights Council, I have the honour to chair the Commission of Inquiry into the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the position of human rights in that country. I share the honour of being a member of the Commission with Sonia Biserko. She is an experienced human rights leader from Serbia, and also Marzuki Darusman, who is a very distinguished lawyer from Indonesia, former Attorney General of that country, and now the Special Rapporteur on Democratic People's Republic of Korea. It was his report that led to the suggestion that the Human Rights Council should create a commission of inquiry. The purpose of that commission is to report to the Human Rights Council in March of next year on a series of nine identified subject matters. All of those subject matters have been the subject of our inquiry to date, and the inquiry is continuing. As I indicated to the Commission on Human Rights this morning, the Council on Human Rights this morning, the Commission of Inquiry has had public hearings in Seoul, in the Republic of Korea, and in Japan, in Tokyo. The recordings of the testimony of those public hearings is available on the website of the Commission of Inquiry, and I would invite all of you to have a look at the testimony, not only for the substance of what it states, but also as revealing the independence, impartiality, and integrity of the work of the Commission itself. The voices and images of the people who speak to us are extremely powerful on such subjects as political detention camps, starvation, the issues of abduction, discrimination against people for various reasons, and all of this is covered in hour after hour of testimony. There are also transcripts of the Japan hearings, and we hope very shortly to have transcripts in the English language of the hearings in Seoul. So that is where it is. The Commission will be proceeding to further hearings. We hope to have public hearings in England, London, and in New York and Washington. Excuse me for falling ill. This doesn't often happen to me in my many years as a judge, I never missed a day's work. And coincidentally, a form of illness that I suffer, the last time I suffered it was 50 years ago in Syria. So Syria and the inquiry of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are locked together in my mind, just as the last time I was ill was on the road from Baalbek to Beirut. But here we are in Geneva. I've told you about the Commission of Inquiry, who we are, what we're doing, and I'd be very happy now to endeavour to answer your questions. Are there any questions? Yes.
Nick. Nick Cumming, Bruce, writing for the Herald Tribune. You were expecting, I think, to go to China. Did you apply to go to China? What happened to that application? You didn't mention it now as one of the places you expect to go, but is there any chance that you will be given access?
Well, we're hoping that the Chinese mission will agree to our proceeding to China. We hope to continue our dialogue with the ambassador of China, and it is our hope that that will be possible. But we have received a great deal of information concerning the situation at the borderland between DPRK and the People's Republic of China. That testimony is online and is available to you and to us, and so we hope to go, but that is still a subject of dialogue and negotiation.
Yes, thank you. Lionel Faton, Japanese news agency. You mentioned in your oral update the issue of accountability. I would like to ask you, assuming that you will not get access to DPRK before your March report, how are you confident that you will be able to settle this issue of accountability and, provide maybe a list to the High Commissioner of Human Rights?
Well, the issue of accountability is in the mandate of the Commission, and therefore we will be obliged to deal with that issue, and we will. We will have before us a very large body of information concerning wrongdoing and breaches of fundamental human rights. Numerous questions have been addressed to issues of individual and institutional accountability. Those questions have been directed at the witnesses who came before us, and therefore if we don't have access to DPRK before we have to report next March, we still will have a great body of information and testimony. It is important to emphasise the huge range of the material that has been made available to us. It is very admirable that so many people who have suffered have been willing to come forward and give testimony, and that they have done so with courage and that testimony includes evidence on issues of accountability. So it would be highly desirable that we have access to the places mentioned, but even without access, we have very specific identification of places of human rights violation, and we also have satellite imagery which takes us into DPRK in a way that simply wouldn't have been possible in earlier decades. We will be following up the satellite imagery and testimony on it, on its precision, on its accuracy, and on exactly what it shows. We'll be doing that mainly at public hearings which we hope to hold in Washington, D.C., with people who are expert in that form of technology. So whilst access would be highly desirable, it is not the only way by which one can secure information on accountability.
Just follow up. So will you provide the High Commissioner for Human Rights with a list of names of individual and institution in March?
I have a feeling that you asked me this question when I was last here.
Maybe.
you have a great interest in an envelope and a sealed envelope with material in it. As I indicated in the oral update this morning, the Commission of Inquiry is not a judge and is not a prosecutor. As to how we'll go about the issues of accountability, I cannot at this stage say, because we still have evidence to gather, we have to sift and analyse the evidence we have. Issues of accountability are not to be lightly tackled. They have to be tackled with care and fairness and integrity. And you can be sure that we will be tackling the issue because of the fact that it's in our mandate. As to whether there will be an envelope with names, which is, I think, the way you put the question last time, that will just have to remain to be seen.
Stephanie?
Sorry, my question was along the same lines as to whether you have begun to, even in a very preliminary way, begin to establish names or chains of command in institutions that you suspect of being behind these possible crimes against humanity.
Well, we certainly have, in a preliminary way, received testimony that identifies both persons who are in charge of particular prison camps, where witnesses who came before us have suffered apparent loss of their dignity and of their fundamental human rights. Questions were addressed to the issues relevant to accountability. If you care to examine the website and you go to those witnesses who are giving testimony concerning the issues of political camps, for example, you will find that questions were targeted on issues addressed to the question of accountability. And in addition to that, some testimony has been given to us orally, but there is also a great wealth of evidence in writing concerning the hierarchical structure of decision-making responsibility in the DPRK. There appears to be no real contest or dispute about that structure and about the persons who play key decisions in that structure. And all of that will be available to us and will form a basis on which questions of accountability will ultimately have to be answered.
Jonathan?
Jonathan Fowler from AFP. Some of the testimony that you cited this morning is pretty stark stuff. I mean, babies being drowned in buckets, people being watching relatives being executed in prison camps. Would it be fair to say that, I mean, in the world today, this kind of situation is without parallel? Or, I mean, is there any historical precedent for this kind of behaviour?
Well, as a result of something that has been said to me in recent days, an image flashed across my mind of the arrival of Allied soldiers, Russian, American, British, at the end of the Second World War, and the discovery of prison camps in those countries, in the countries that had been occupied by the Nazi forces. And the feelings of shock, horror and distaste, even amongst those people who had been battle-hardened and who were aware in general terms of the existence of camps in Germany. I'm not saying that the situation in North Korea is exactly analogous, and one of the problems of not being able to enter into the territory of DPRK is that one cannot see what is there with one's own eyes. But there is satellite imagery and there are extremely vivid statements. And some of the stories, as you have said, are atrocious and truly shocking. After 34 years as a judge, one becomes rather battle-hardened too. And it is rare indeed that material in a court really upset or disturb me. It's in a way a sad thing to say that, but you have to immure yourself from some pretty shocking stories in one's own country. But nonetheless, the material that we received in the oral hearings had a very profound effect on all of the commissioners, and I suggest it will have a profound effect on you. I can't expect that people in this room will sit there for hour after hour and listen to everything and watch everything. But even if you take a sample and have a look at it, I believe that you will be very distressed and disturbed by it, and that you will have reactions similar to those of General Eisenhower and the others who came upon the camps in post-war Europe. And one of the reasons for establishing the United Nations in 1945, and one of the reasons for creating the system of universal human rights, was to respond to that situation and to pledge in humanity that we would not have repetitions of that situation. And that's why to talk only of national sovereignty without talking also of the universal human rights, which were created as a result of the discoveries in Asia as well as Europe at the end of the Second World War, is to ignore history and to ignore the commitment of the United Nations in the Charter, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and in the United Nations treaties which have followed the Second World War and that come together in the Council of Human Rights of the United Nations. It's important to remember history because, as is often said, those who don't remember history are doomed to continue making the same mistakes.
Any other questions? In the back.
Yeah, thank you. Frédéric Durand with NHK, Japanese Public TV. We heard this morning the representative of DPRK saying that they reject this commission and also all the Human Rights Council resolutions. So they restated that they will not cooperate. What do you think could, what kind of, I don't know, pressure exercise perhaps by the international community or some member states could help move a bit in a more cooperative way for the DPRK?
Well, the Commission of Inquiry has no blue helmets. We have no way of forcing the government of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to change its mind. We, however, have the very considerable strength of having been created by the Council on Human Rights without any expressed dissent at the time, and without even the requirement of a vote. That is rather unusual that that should be done, but it was done in the case of the Commission of Inquiry on DPRK. And therefore, we start from that position. We start also with a great deal of goodwill, although there were many in the room who expressed some reservations about the idea of having nation-focused commissions of inquiry and mandates. Nonetheless, I don't believe there was any real attack on the integrity and independence of the Commission of Inquiry and of the care with which it's going about its work. The political decision having been made, political in the broad sense of creating a Commission of Inquiry, now we, an independent body, have to set about doing what we can. And the holding of the public hearings and the insertion of the transcripts and of the images on the World Wide Web, available in every country in the world, except one might say in North Korea itself, where access to the internet is reserved to a very few in the elite, will itself, I hope, build up a demand amongst people of goodwill and decency everywhere that we must have engagement. There was repeated statement by those who had reservations about the system concerning the need for dialogue. But as I said in the reply in the Commission of Inquiry this morning, you can't have dialogue without mutuality. You can't have dialogue without engagement. You can't have a dialogue with yourself. I suppose one can have a dialogue with oneself, and all of us do in one way or other, but they're generally rather unfruitful. A dialogue with the government and people of DPRK would be the best way to respond to the suggestion that what is being voiced by the witnesses is slander, that the witnesses are scum, and that they're engaged in a political attack on DPRK. I don't believe that if you look at the oral testimonies online that you will come to any conclusion other than that these are ordinary, somewhat courageous people who have come forward to give their voices in the hope that their children and children's children will not go through the kind of degrading and ferocious treatment that they've been subjected to.
Nick?
Has any of the information and the satellite imagery you've seen so far led you to any conclusions about the number of active prison camps, whether they are becoming more numerous or expanding in size?
Yes, the testimony does suggest that there has been some degree of consolidation of prison camps and therefore a reduction to some extent in the number of prison camps and perhaps also some reduction in the number of persons in those camps. However, whether this is because of state policy to reduce the number of political prisoners, or whether it is simply the result of the fearsome punishment that has, according to the evidence, been meted out in those camps, and the whether that is an explanation, or whether simply the fact that many, many people die in those camps is an explanation of the fall off in the number of prisoners and of the number of camps. One of the witnesses said something which I could understand during his testimony. He said that if you are young and you end up in one of those camps, as you can through guilt by association, and if you are young, you will face with a certain degree of acceptance the necessity to eat mice and rodents and to eat grasshoppers and lizards just for protein, because being young, you are more adaptable and you know that you have to do that to survive. But if you are older, and he then fixed me with a baleful stare, if you are older, you simply cannot tolerate that. You cannot adjust to it. It is just not possible for you to eat rats and other rodents, and therefore you die. And if that testimony is in the end a true reflection of what the prisoners go through, then the dying of large numbers of prisoners, the removal of their corpses into pots, the burning of the corpses, but not a complete burning, the scattering of the ashes and of the body parts over the nearby vegetable fields, are simply a result of a shocking lack of attention to the human dignity and needs of the prisoners in the prison camps and their families. We're talking here of very large numbers of people, 100,000 or more, and therefore we're talking about a huge imposition on a very large and important section of the populace of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So the answer is there does appear to be a fall-off in the number of camps. There may be a fall-off in the number of prisoners, but why exactly that is not entirely clear. And it's one of the reasons why access would solve many of these problems. If, for example, it is said that these are simply agricultural camps with happy volunteer workers, then the easiest way to demonstrate that would be to allow access. We have the most precise identification of exactly where these camps are, and it would not therefore be difficult to get access to the place and to see exactly what they demonstrate.
In the back, and then Jonathan.
John Halpern, Associated Press. Just a quick follow on that. In March, when the commission was approved, Navi Pillay said that they had evidence that there were up to 200,000 political prisoners. So if you now say over 100,000, that would be a huge fall off.
Well, I may have the wrong exact number, and it may still be a greater number than 100,000. But 100,000, 50,000, 20,000, 4,000 is too many. And the exact number will be the subject of differing evidence to the extent that individual prisoners can give an indication of the overall number. The best source of the overall number would be the government of DPRK. And the second best source would be to allow access to the country for inspection. But there is secondary evidence. There are three white papers available in the Republic of Korea from various national institutions, and of course there are foreign observers, including David Hawke, who have conducted a lifetime's research over the last 20 years into the detention camps, and they will be secondary sources of evidence that, in default of access, we will have to rely on.
Any other questions? Yes.
My name is Masaki Jiji, Press Japanese News Agency. We are here talking about tortures, abductions, and the prison camps. In a series of human violation cases, could you give us some example in what fact or situation could make you to determine the crime against humanity? Thank you.
Well, I think it's a little premature to go into the detailed analysis that would be required. A crime against humanity is, of course, an intensely serious and act against international law, and it is accompanied by elements either of deliberate conduct or of such gross and unacceptable neglect as to effectively amount to deliberate conduct. And we will have to analyse the evidence that we have to make decisions concerning the deliberate or conduct or otherwise that is established by the testimony. We did have one expert evidence in the Republic of Korea who was an expert in food sources and in the availability of food and in the problem of starvation which had arisen in the DPRK during the mid-1990s, the so-called Great Famine and Arduous March. And he was asked questions concerning whether, in his view, the starvation of sections of the population in DPRK was part of a deliberate government policy. His answer was that he didn't think that it was part of a deliberate policy to deliberately starve the population. But a question still hangs in the air, and the question is, if you know that a very large number in your population, say a third, are dying for want of access to food, if you know that international resources would, on conditions of accountability and monitoring, be available to alleviate that suffering, and if instead you proceed to expend huge amounts on military and international military expenditures and domestic military expenditures, then when does gross negligence move into deliberate conduct? When a person is faced with the consequences, shocking and outrageous, of the death of very large numbers whose bodies were normally taken and left near the railway stations, when you know that this is happening all the time, but you fail either to seek alleviation or fail to remove the alternative source of expenditures that could save people's lives, has that moved from gross incompetence and negligence into the area of deliberate conduct? About 7 centuries ago, a judge in England said, "The devil himself knoweth not the mind of man." By that he meant it's very hard for even the devil, and certainly for human beings, to look into human motivation. And the way we human beings tend to do it is to look into conduct and to draw inferences. That's all we can do, because we can't always effectively look into what was in the mind and heart of human beings. But you can be assured that we will be looking into the mind and heart of those who have responsibility for the population in North Korea, and we will be looking at it in terms of practicality, common sense, and the pattern of conduct and the consequences of the pattern of conduct that undoubtedly led to very large numbers of people, and not only in prison camps, dying and their bodies left to be picked up and removed.
Hiro.
Hiro Maegawa from Asahi Shimbun, Japan newspaper. I have a quick questions on the methodology for the future. I believe in Pyongyang there are many foreign delegation based, and I believe some international organization like ICRC and some UN agency. I believe UNICEF had some access there. Reaching out for some of those information that you could get through all the diplomatic channel? Thank you.
Yes, if bodies are within the United Nations family, we have the strength of the resolution of the Council, the Human Rights Council, which urges members of the United Nations family to cooperate with the COI. But even if they're not members of the United Nations family, we can still reach out to them, and we will do so, and we'll be doing that in a number of places, and have already endeavoured to engage with international institutions, and in particular those who are present on the ground. I don't want to be too specific about this for obvious reasons, but we will be endeavouring to overcome the difficulties that are presented to us. But as I did this morning, I do want to emphasise that the testimony we have is not wholly secondary testimony. We do have some secondary testimony. For example, the Bar Association of Korea and the Republic of Korea has a white paper on a great deal of research. And similarly, the Korean Institute for National Reconciliation and other bodies, they have their white papers. So there's a great deal of material that has been collected. But as well as that, we have a lot of primary testimony from people who have quite recently escaped from North Korea. Some of that is online, some of it is in confidential submissions that we have received. And all of that will be used by us to endeavour to make contact, and also, even if that fails, to endeavour to build up a picture in our mind of what it is like in Democratic People's Republic of Korea, whether things are improving a bit or whether things are still as bad as the testimony we've received suggests they are.
Any other questions?
Again, just curiosity, could you just explain how did you get the mutuality from your experience in Cambodia? Maybe this could help in the future dialogue with North Korea. I would like to know more about it. Thank you.
Well, I don't really think that it's appropriate for me to go into detail about the past. I was special representative in Cambodia in 1993-1996, so that's 20 years ago. And a lot has happened in Cambodia since. But Cambodia at that time had just emerged from the UNTAC period. It had just emerged with a very large and successful free and fair election conducted under the auspices of the United Nations. It had a very viable civil society. It had a large number of international institutions which were present. There was a great deal of goodwill and there was a great desire to overcome the terrible sufferings that had occurred during the Khmer Rouge period. As Prime Minister Hun Sen once told me, there was not a single family in Cambodia which had not suffered as a result of the Khmer Rouge. And there was a great candour about that time and a willingness to speak about it and to engage about it. Engaging about such great wrongs is the first step to remedying them and making sure that they're not repeated. Now, none of those features is available in North Korea, and therefore the situation is quite different. I can't get in there, I can't engage with civil society such as it is, I can't speak to the people, I can't speak to leaders, I can't speak to critics of the government, and I can't even speak to the government itself. This morning at the Human Rights Council was the very first time I had a dialogue with the an oral dialogue with the representative of the DPRK. And in today's world, in the world of the internet and of communications, instantaneous communications, it's an amazing thing that that should still exist in the modern age. And I there and then offered, on whatever conditions we could work out, to engage in that dialogue. I've spent a whole lifetime trying to be fair. That has been my life's commitment. And I am trying to be fair in this exercise. And I know my colleagues and our secretariat have that commitment. So that the idea of dialogue is embraced, but not dialogue with the Commission of Inquiry. I do not accept that the people who came before us are scum. And I challenge everyone in this room to look at those people who gave testimony and reach your own conclusions. And I'm sure you will not consider that the mother of a daughter in Japan or the prisoner who was born into a prison by guilt by association in Korea is scum. These are ordinary human beings. And this is the whole point of universal human rights. We have a lot in which we differ, and that is as it should be. But we also have a lot on which we have things in common, simply because we are humans. We have our bodies and our thoughts and our love and our desire to live with one another, generally in peace. And so I hope that our appeal today will reach the leaders of DPRK and will result in a new chapter. That, after all, is what is the purpose of setting up universal human rights and setting up the Council on Human Rights in this building.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Good to see you again.